Margaret Truman has a new book coming out about her father, a book which contains revelations that she promised him would not be published until long after he and Margaret Truman's mother both had died. It especially, in pre-publication notices, reveals some of the thoughts and comments and letters of our 33rd president about his predecessor, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Harry Truman describes Roosevelt as being an egotist and says that it's because of his egotism and self-centeredness that he successfully ran four times to become the President of the United States. Now, compare that to the 1960 presidential campaign of Richard Nixon. When running against then-Senator John Kennedy, Nixon said that the reason he should be elected is because he had vast and greater experience in the decisions of government because he had been involved in all of the major decisions of his vice presidency during the 8 years of the Eisenhower administration. Following up on that campaign approach, a reporter asked Dwight Eisenhower to name some of the great decisions that Richard Nixon had been involved in. Not much helping his vice president's campaign, Dwight Eisenhower said, "Give me a few months and maybe I can think of one." Well, there's a relationship between predecessors and successors, which is typified in the relationship between these presidents and vice presidents. But it's a problem not just of presidents. It's also an issue for pastors and for coaches. It's an issue for children who follow an older brother or sister through a school system. It's an issue for a second husband or a second wife in a marriage. What we do and how we relate to those who precede us and those who follow us. I offer to you the story that you may think to be irrelevant, for it is the story of two Old Testament prophets with the very unlikely names of Elijah and Elisha. Irrelevant in the sense that it would seem that that which happened 800 or 900 years before the birth of Jesus Christ would not have much to do with our lives today or issues of predecessors and successors. And yet I would contend that their story is well worthy of being studied in the best of business schools in America, or ought to be considered by those involved in executive searches, the headhunters of our country, or anyone else that deals with this significant issue of relationship. The story itself is really quite too long to even adequately summarize, for it covers 19 chapters of the Old Testament books of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, a period that could be described as terrible times. I mean, if you get discouraged by what's happening in our world today, if you read the newspaper and it kind of depresses you, all the drug busts and the national debt and the fluctuations in the value of the dollar, or when you're watching the news and all five of the lead stories are about murders near and far, or rapes, or terrible trends within our society, when you are tempted to think that things could never be and certainly never have been worse, then I suggest you read 1 and 2 Kings, because you'll find that there were terrible times long before that which we face today. I give you just a few examples. Politically, ancient Israel was divided, north and south, much like our Union and Confederacy during the Civil War. So those who related to one another were enemies of one another. And there was not just civil war, but international war as well. Battles where tens of thousands of men would die in single events. Many times they would define the seasons of the year not in terms of spring or fall, but say it was the season of the year when kings went forth to war, because it was that typical time when one nation would engage in warfare against another nation. But some of the things that happened, aside from the terrible bloodshed that almost decimated the male population of those ancient countries, were the negotiations that sometimes took place. For example, the Aramaeans were about to attack the capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel, Samaria, and the king of Aram, Ben-Hadad, sent a message to King Ahab, the Israeli. He said, "I'm not going to attack your city, but instead what I want to do is come in and take the best of your wives for my harem, the best of your children to become slaves, and all of your silver and gold to be added to my savings." King Ahab knew he was outnumbered. Militarily, he was not likely to win. And so his response was, "Yes, my Lord and my King, whatever is mine is yours." Or the king of Moab was involved in a battle when he thought he could pierce the enemy lines militarily by sending out 700 of his best swordsmen. They failed miserably and were slaughtered. And so he decided to switch from a military to a spiritual approach, and he needed to offer a suitable and significant sacrifice to his heathen deity. He therefore went up on the wall of his capital city and killed his own son, the crown prince and heir apparent, as a human sacrifice to his god so that he could win the battle that day. The treatment of children in ancient days was atrocious. If you got behind in the payments on a loan, the bill collector would come and not dun you for the money, but take your child to be sold into slavery. In fact, people would routinely sell their children when they had financial reverses. One time in Samaria, when the economy was a wreck, when they were under siege, and when famine was at its worst, the top price in the city was for a dead donkey's head for people to eat, because that was the only meat that was available for purchase. It was at the same time that the king of Israel was walking through the city, and two women asked if he would mediate a dispute. And of course, that's part of what a king was supposed to do in ancient times. And the woman said, "We were hungry and we were desperate, and so we contracted together. And we agreed that last night we would kill and eat my baby for dinner, and tonight we would kill and eat her baby for dinner. And last night we ate my child, and now it's time to eat her child, and she's hidden the child. And so, Your Majesty, we ask you to mediate the difference." Terrible times. We think we live in terrible times when front page news deals with male prostitution in and around Loring Park and a proposed ordinance before the Minneapolis City Council and what the police are trying to do to reduce prostitution in our twin cities. But let me tell you that in the ancient times of Elijah and Elisha, prostitution was not only legal, but it was part of worship. So people would go to the temple, and part of their worship of their gods was to have sex with temple prostitutes, male and female alike. Terrible times? I'm not sure that I can measure that one time is more terrible than another, but I would suggest that it was at least as bad then as it is today in Panama and Colombia and Lebanon and South Africa or on the Main Street or Wall Street of the United States. Terrible times, truly terrible times in which they lived. If you go back and read the biblical history of Israel, you will find that there were three especially terrible times. One was during the era of Moses, when for 400 years the nation of Israel was in captivity in Egypt and treated abominably. The second was during the era of Elijah and Elisha, and the third was in the era of Jesus in his earthly life and ministry. But also, as you read through the biblical history, you find that there were three periods when there were great divine demonstrations of miraculous grace and power. And those three times were the eras of Moses, Elijah and Elisha, and Jesus Christ. In fact, you can read pages and pages, chapters and chapters, covering hundreds of years in the Bible and never find a single miracle. Some might say that miracles are relatively uncommon and infrequent, except for periods when they seem to be dense in the narrative of the Scripture. And those periods when they are most frequent are precisely those periods when life was most terrible. I find a principle from that. A principle that I find applicable and experienced in my own life. That it is precisely when things seem the worst that God seems to demonstrate himself the best and the most. That in the roller coaster experiences of life, that when at the peak and the horizon is broad and it seems as if everything is exhilarating, that there is a tendency to forget about God and not particularly need him. But when you sense the speed of going down, the fear that grips your heart, When you think that you've reached the bottom, you discover that there's a lower bottom yet ahead. It is precisely then that there are the greatest demonstrations of God's goodness, of God's grace, and God's miracles. The Lord has an enormous sense of appropriateness. And so there were these great divine demonstrations of the power of God during those terrible times of Elijah. The list is, again, too long for me to rehearse, so I only give you a few examples. If you look at a map of ancient or modern Palestine, and you trace it, you'll see that up here is on the coast of the Mediterranean, Lebanon, and pretty much a smooth coast with a bowl-like shape that comes around eventually to Egypt and over to North Africa, except for one bump that's along the coastline. It's west of the Sea of Galilee, just south of Tyre and Sidon that have so much been in the news with the Lebanon crisis of late. In that bump is a ridge, a mountain ridge, that is called Mount Carmel. It was there that one of the all-time great confrontations of history took place. A confrontation between the powers of the ancient heathen deity Baal and Yahweh, the God of heaven and earth and the Lord of Israel. Baal had 450 priests to represent him. Yahweh had one prophet, Elijah. The contest was set up like this, that the stones were placed in an altar fashion for a ring around which there was a trench dug. In the middle of the ring of stones was placed firewood, and on top of the firewood was placed in each of the two a butchered bull. The contest was to determine which one could be supernaturally set afire. The rules were clear. No matches, can't flick your bic. Nothing like that was to be allowed, but only prayer and requesting that the deity intervene. Since that was especially the territory of the god Baal, Baal's 450 priests prayed first, and they pleaded for fire to come from their god, but none came. And so they became increasingly fervent in what they had to say. And Elijah, who was second in this contest, stood at the side and some might consider him to be unduly sarcastic, when he suggested that maybe Baal was a little bit hard of hearing and maybe his hearing aid had a dead battery in it, or maybe he said he's gone traveling, he's away on vacation or a business trip, leave a message on his answering machine, and maybe he'll get back to you later. And as he made all these sarcastic remarks, these 450 priests of Baal eventually went into a frenzy. They're dancing around, they're hysterical. They began to take knives and whips and mutilate themselves, trying to get the attention of their god so that they could get the fire lighted and prove that their god was the true god. But after all day of all their attempts, there was no success. And then it became Elijah's turn. He simply and forthrightly prayed to Yahweh. At the conclusion of his prayer, zah, the flames and the bolt of lightning came from heaven, consumed not only the sacrifice and the wood, but the rocks and the dirt and the water in the trench all around. And there that day, God, in terrible times, demonstrated himself and was, for all the nations of that day and that world, vindicated. That time was in the midst of a terrible drought, a drought that had far-reaching effects on all the people. It had gone over 3 years, more than 36 months. There had not been a single drop of rain nor even a cloud in the sky. The crops, they had all been parched and failed. Most of the livestock were dead, and the people were very, very close to starvation. And Elijah again prayed. This time, he laid flat on the ground, his face down, prayed 7 times, not because God did not hear him the first 6, but so that it would be clearly evident that it was not because of his prayers, but because of God's answer. At the conclusion of the 7th prayer in succession, his servant, his assistant who was working for him, was instructed to look to the west out over the Mediterranean and see if there were any clouds, any hope of rain to come. The servant, having looked 6 previous times and not wanting to bring any more bad news to his master, the last time looked and looked and maybe thinking his imagination had gotten the better of him and hoping to be optimistic, said, "Sure. You know, I think there is. I mean, right over there, there's a cloud. It's about the size of a man's hand." And Elijah said, "Run before you get drenched." And he goes tearing down the mountain, trying to escape this torrential downpour, which came like the rains of Hurricane Hugo, an enormous storm in response to the man who prayed that God would intervene in the terrible times of a drought. It was during that drought that he went to the pagan city of Zarephath. Elijah there saw a sad sight. It was a widow woman with her son, her child, gathering up sticks. She was going to have a fire and take the last little bit of oil and dough and bake a little loaf, and they were going to eat it together as their last meal, for there was no other food for them, nor any available, even if they had the money or the means to secure it. Seeing their pathetic circumstances, Elijah came and did what seems almost to be an abrasive thing. He asks that she first bake some bread for him, and then that she not bake all of the dough nor use all of the oil, but to take some of it, and then more of it, and more of it, claiming that God would miraculously intervene and that neither the dough nor the oil would be depleted as long as the drought continued. So day after day, week after week, for months and eventually for years, the supply never ran out as God miraculously demonstrated his supernatural ability in terrible, terrible times. But that was not the worst of days for that widow woman. You see, it was sometime later that her son died. That, of course, was a great personal and emotional loss. But it was almost impossible in ancient times for a widow to make it without a husband or without a son. It was almost her writ of execution to her herself. She went to Elijah and said, "Did you preserve my son's life once so that he only later in bitterness can be taken from me?" Elijah, then the vehicle of God's great intervention in terrible times, did an extraordinary thing. He went and laid over the top of that child, with his body's warmth over that child's coldness, his breath where there was no breath. And he prayed that God would do something of which there is no previous record in Scripture or ancient history, that God would bring that child back to life again. And the child lived. You don't find much of that in the Bible or anywhere else. But God was demonstrating his greatness in terrible times. Elijah's life on earth even ended spectacularly, for he is one of only two characters in all of the Bible who never died. He was actually transported in a heavenly supernatural chariot directly into the presence of God without going through the gate of death. And my question to you is how you follow a guy like that. I mean, if you're next, and this guy is constantly speaking for God, raising the dead, feeding people for weeks and months, bringing down drought and rain, calling fire from heaven, and then skips out in a chariot that goes directly to heaven, what do you do for the next show? I mean, I've had times where I've been invited to be a speaker, like at a banquet. And sometimes before saying yes, I ask, what else is on the program? And I find out it's a program that lasts 3 or 4 hours, and they have great food and terrific music and jugglers and comedians and dramas and all that. And then I'm at the end, you know, beginning around 10:45 at night. And I think to myself, let's see, when is that? Oh, September of 1998. You know, I'm not sure, but I think I have a commitment that night. I mean, I get a commitment. It's somebody's birthday. It has to be. I mean, I don't want to follow that kind of an act. And yet, that's exactly what Elisha was called upon to do. It's hard to follow a great act or a most unusual ending. Ask the Johnsons, who succeeded the martyred presidents of the United States, Lincoln and Kennedy, or anybody else who has followed someone who has been enormously successful. And yet, Elisha turned out to be the very best. I want to be careful that I don't somehow say that which he did was equal to or greater than that which Elijah did. Although, I suppose that could be argued. For Elisha also spoke to and spoke for God. He also became God's vehicle for the miraculous and the gracious in terrible times. For example, when the community well at Jericho was poisoned, he went and took a bowl of salt and threw it in, and it was made clean and good to drink until this day. Or he took a single meal, and with it, he fed 20 men. Or in a miracle similar to that performed by Elijah, he dealt with a woman who was instructed to take a single jug of oil and to get every container that she could borrow or buy or in any way use and fill every one of them up with oil, and that jug from which she poured was not depleted until everything was filled to the brim. It was Elisha who dealt with a woman who struggled with a problem of infertility. And when he sensed her difficulty and desperation, it was the prophet Elisha who said, "A year from now you'll have a son." And she did. But he was also there sometime later when that son died. And it was he also who prayed that God again would bring the dead back to life and the woman's son was returned. Again and again in terrible times, God, through yet another prophet with a similar name, demonstrated his greatness. But I find it, I think, equally amazing, equal to all of the miracles, the relationship between these two great men in terrible times. The problems of success in relationship to succession are legend. Again and again, we have throughout history and through our own experience how difficult it is for one person with great gifts to follow someone else with great gifts. You might, at least in this case, from 1 and 2 Kings, call it the problem of the prophets, for there are problems that seem often, at least, to go with that office. A prophet is someone who usually is very focused and has little peripheral vision. Someone who is single issue. Someone who is devoted to a cause. Someone who is willing to stand absolutely alone if everybody else disagrees. Someone who is often unbending, inflexible. Someone who has enormous inner strength and close relationship with God. Someone who is willing to plow through all of the circumstances and move ahead when other people quickly would give up. Someone who on the downside is often alone, maybe lonely. Someone who sometimes struggles with issues of discouragement and even depression. Let me tell you, if you are seriously considering marrying a prophet, you want to get at least 10 years of premarital counseling before you go ahead with this. I mean, this is a big decision you're going to make. And at the end of the 10 years, you want a two-year sort of intermission before you actually go through with it, because prophets can be tough people to deal with, to have a relationship with. Which makes it yet all the more amazing, the relationship between Elijah and Elisha, who were both great prophets, but who also were great friends. I think that there are some reasons for that. It certainly has to begin with their conviction of providence. That is, that God is completely in charge, that God is the one who rules all of the circumstances of life, whether they be great or small. It is because of that kind of faith in God that these men, when times were terrible, were not hopelessly discouraged. It's because of their conviction that God was involved in all of the details of life that when they were able to do the spectacular, they remained humble nevertheless. They had a sense that God was the one who fits all the pieces together, even when it seems those pieces do not fit. That God is the one who, when everything is going awry, will bring it to a right conclusion at the end. When it seems as if God has forgotten, that he has neither forgotten nor forsaken. It is that conviction in the providence of God's goodness, God's grace, God's sovereignty, that enabled those prophets to get through all that they went through from the heights to the depths. Let me suggest that a conviction of the providence of God serves us quite well yet today. For there come times in our lives when we wonder if God has forgotten or forsaken. We have times when things are going very, very well, that if we lack a conviction in the providence of God, we might take the credit to ourselves. It might be ruined by our pride. Or when things are very, very bad, that we might give up, saying there is no hope, and succumb to despair. It is a conviction in the providence of God that says that all these pieces of the puzzle of life, jagged as they are, and some seemingly missing, will in fact in the end fit together and have a picture that is complete and that is good. They had a conviction in the providence of God that not only got them through, but kept them together. They also had a sense of station in life. Or maybe you would prefer to say a sense of divine calling. Maybe I didn't tell you before that Elisha used to be Elijah's assistant, or more accurately, his servant. Elisha, in his own right, was a gifted and capable man. But when he had the role of a servant, it was that role which he lived. He did whatever Elijah wanted, and there is never a hint of ambition or jealousy or a desire to replace the person whom God had anointed and put in that very special place. And yet, when the mantle came off of Elijah and onto Elisha, he quickly changed roles from being no longer a servant, no longer being the prophet elect waiting, but rather instead being the prophet himself speaking for God and the channel through which the divine demonstrations would take place. I know there's a risk of misunderstanding when talking about sensing one's station in life, because there are those who have sinfully discriminated against other people because of race, or because of gender, or because of education or socioeconomic place in life, and have said, well, just be content with your station. No, it's not that about which we speak at all, for such discrimination is truly inappropriate and truly sinful. But what we speak of is that call of God that God at this point has said, this is where you are and this is what you are to do. And in that, to excel and find satisfaction with the conviction that the God of providence is the God of calling as well. When I was a graduate student, I met a man who was a man of certain power and prestige on the West Coast in Southern California. A man whose name may not be all that impressive to you, but at least up to that time, he was the most famous person I'd ever met. So he finished a lecture when I was in school, and I did something that for me was almost kind of out of character. I went up afterwards and introduced myself to him and invited him out to eat at a restaurant that night. I'd never done anything like that before. I'm not sure I can recall having done that since. That's not typically what I would do, but he said yes, and so we went out and I got acquainted with him, and I was really impressed with who he knew and what he was doing and all the things that were in his small empire. And I said something to him that, you know, now in reflection was rather audacious. I said to him, now, what happens when you die? It wasn't a very flattering thing to say to a new friend, but what happens to everything that you've done? And he said to me, Leith, you know, whenever God has an Elijah on the stage, he has an Elisha waiting in the wings. I thought that was good. It's a sense that life, that history, that the world is the playing out of the divine drama, and that God is the director of it. And it is not for us always to choose our roles, but simply to sense the station to which God has called us and to play that part well in obedience to God. Elijah and Elisha had a conviction, the providence of God, and a sense of their own station in life. And they excelled in the station which they held. But add to that yet something equally unusual, and that is the care, the concern that they had for one another. For that, I read to you from the historian's log. It's in 2 Kings chapter 2. It's the actual transition from the prophet times of Elijah to the prophet times of Elisha. The historian tells us that when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "but do not speak of it." And Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. The company of the prophets of Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yeah, I know," he replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. 50 men of the company of the prophets went and stood at a distance facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit," Elisha replied. "Ah, you've asked a difficult thing," Elijah said. "Yet if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours, otherwise not." As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them, and Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw and cried out, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel!" Elisha saw him no more. And then he took hold of his own clothes and he tore them apart. He picked up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah, went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. Then he took the cloak that had fallen from him and struck the water with it. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asked. When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. The company of the prophets from Jericho who were watching said, "The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha." They went to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. You know, it's really extraordinary. Elisha wouldn't take no for an answer. He stuck with his mentor and prophet to the very end. And then at the very end, Elijah's final words to his successor are, "What can I do for you? How can I help you succeed?" No competition. No jealousy. No one-upmanship here. These men genuinely cared for each other and provided for one another because they were convinced of the providence of God and their sense of their station, their call in life. Now, I think we've got a shortage today of Elijahs and Elishas. We need some Elijahs who will demonstrate God in the worst of times and will not hog God for themselves, but will seek Elishas who will be their successors. And we need Elishas who are willing to excel in whatever the current station of life may be, whether it's humble or whether it's great. Elijahs and Elishas together who will take directions from God in the stage of life and the stage of history and be his representatives in the best of times and in the worst of times. That God's greatness at all times may be demonstrated, that his love may come through, that he may receive the glory. It doesn't take a lot. Just one, or two, or three of you to be for today Elijah or Elisha.